Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel News. I'm your host, David Price. Thank you for joining me today. You are going to hear from Steve and company. And before that, though, I just want to give a quick my thoughts on the first five parts of the trial of Jean Grey going on in Brian Michael Bendis's All-New X-Men and Guardians of the Galaxy. Beautifully illustrated across both titles by Stuart Immonen and Wade Von Grawbadger and Sarah Pacelli. And it is... I like pretty much everything about it, even to a degree the Jean Grey parts. But the parts with Cyclops, with Scott, and his classmates, really well. I love the interaction between the students and Peter Quill's Guardians of the Galaxy. And I haven't read, I need to go back, and I read the Zero issue, and I haven't really read any of the Guardians issues up until 11, or whichever issue. Yeah, I think 11. Whichever issue is the first part of the... actually, it's part two, but the first Guardians issue. And I am liking it a whole lot. It's I read the Abnett Landing stuff, and I read the stuff during Annihilation, and well, I read these characters during the Annihilation Conquest, and then the spin-off series, and it's it really does feel like that as far as the dialogue between everybody. Like I said, the art is fantastic. These particular Guardians, from what I see, and there's really not a whole lot of teamwork, at least in the issues so far. Maybe things will change with the sixth issue, and it probably will because of how the fifth issue, what the events that lead up to the end of the fifth issue, and in that last page, which I'm sure will lead into the sixth part being a big deal. I haven't seen a whole lot of teamwork, or at least in the field. There's been a lot of flying around in a ship, but it's still done well, and it doesn't... it's moving at a pretty good clip. It doesn't feel like anything is dragging. Not sure how much of a taste I get of every individual character. I like the interaction between Gamora and Angela. I'm getting a kick out of Drax and him wanting to... well, yeah, it's... there's a lot of interaction. There are little side things, especially when Laura, when X-23, she has a moment with Cyclops, and then she's pretty much not heard from again until she speaks up, and then Star-Lord even mentions, you know, girl I didn't even know was part of the group. Kitty Pryde is fantastic. There really isn't a bad scene with any of these characters. And as far as what the purpose of the storyline is, of course, the Shi'ar Empire wants Jean Grey to answer for her crime, or crimes, her crime when, or her future criminal act in obliterating countless people. And the that's where things get a little fuzzy, and whether or not, because this person hasn't done these things yet, is that somebody you should be able to judge? So, yeah, it's there's some questions that that I guess we don't really have answers to, at least right up front. But getting there is quite interesting. And then when Jean finds out what the Shi'ar Empire did, and her reaction, and it's I didn't know what to expect, really, because oh, it's the trilogy in Grey, and she isn't one of my favorite characters within the all new X-Men, and so I really didn't. I don't want to say I didn't care what happens to her during this, but I was just saying, hey, you know, Jean Grey's the forefront, and she kind of really hasn't been, except for, you know, when we see her on trial or talking to Oracle. But aside from that, it pretty much is everybody else, including the Starjammers. I think that is fantastic that Scott and Corsair are having some scenes together, and Scott has some questions, and whereas older Scott and Corsair have mended their relationship, and the younger Cyclops hasn't gotten there yet, because he doesn't know everything that the older Cyclops does, and it's there's really, there's a lot going on, and I am really enjoying not just all new X-Men, but this crossover with this book, and I think that Bendis is doing a phenomenal job. I mean, that's the gist. That is what I'm trying to get to. That is, as I've been rambling and meandering around the point, Bendis is doing a fantastic job with the all-new X-Men, and it looks beautiful. And now I need to go back and read the earlier issues of Guardians of the Galaxy so I can catch up to this, because I need to know why. What is going on to cause Peter's father to behave the way he is? Why he's behaving the way he is towards his son, towards the Guardians, and I mean, yeah, you get some of it in the recap page, but I need to see how it plays out, because I'm sure the recap page isn't doing it justice. So I definitely recommend. The trial of Jean Grey, and that's before the final issue of this storyline is out. I just, up until this point, I think it is a great, great read, and there are a couple other things that I'm going to read once I'm done with the episode. Wolverine number 3, which I guess things are, with this third issue, things have come into play that I guess makes sense based on what happened in the first issue, and so I want to read that, and I want to finish that, and I have a Fantastic Four issue to read, so there's some things on my plate that I need to get to, so I will I'm gonna let the guys do their thing, and I'll talk to you soon. So take everybody.
Hey, Piscatorial Pirates. Steve Raker here from the Comic Book Bunker, along with Kevin Whirlwind X and Andrew the L.A. Rabbit. Hi, guys.
Hey, I have expectations for this one.
Hey, guys.
I had so much fun being on Jerry's Great Expectations podcast the other week that Marvel Noise is now going with an all X-Men format. How about that?
Sweet.
Finally, about time, some quality coverage of the X-Men.
All right, Jerry, you can come off the ledge. No, that's not really the case. We had to take a break from the number ones. It was time to get back into an old Marvel Masterwork type material. And, I mean, Phil ran for high ground and made it, but we were able to ensnare Kevin, who was a little bit slower on the step with the hockey skates on, trying to run uphill. So Andrew made the pick this time, and it's the first 10 issues of the X-Men from 1963. The first Marvel Masterworks X-Men, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby.
Or an omniboot that doesn't have a glossy dust jacket. It's one of the only ones like that, so that's very strange.
What is it,
I also
like
have the cover that has the Alex Ross recreation of issue number one.
Oh, cool.
I am actually looking at the Marvel Masterworks Volume 3 from 1987. This was a... An exciting young Andy. when this series came out, I was pretty stoked. I mean, I had read reprint titles before, but to have these classic stories in this cool new hardcover format was quite a thrill, and I remember getting these first few. It started with, of course, Spider-Man was the first, but and then Fantastic Four, and then when the X-Men, I was like, ooh, I gotta get the X-Men. And I had also read some of these stories in those reprints I'd had when I went to Ireland. They had had some of these early stories there. So I was like, this is a chance for me to get some awesomely great comics. But as we've discussed a little bit, they did unique coloring on this edition. It's not reproduced in the subsequent Masterworks, the Omnibus, or in the original issues. So luckily I still have the CD-ROM, and I was able to fire in and get the original color as God intended.
Yeah, and I mean, they've reprinted these Masterworks, and then they also have a soft cover version of the Masterwork that was printed in 2009. These books are also on the X-Men Unlimited, or X-Men, the Marvel Unlimited website. Or app, so they're digestible in a variety of ways. I first encountered them when I was like 10 or 11 there in those Amazing Adventures reprints. It was a reprint title that did the first, 13, 14 issues maybe of X-Men. So that's how I first got to digest these stories. How about you, Kevin?
I don't know if I've... probably a few of the issues, but that was like years and years and years later, like maybe in some random trade or hardcover. But what I really remember some of the stuff from is either Wizard magazine or those Marvel cards you would collect in the early 90s, because you would see like the cover and then you'd be like, oh, that looks so classic or retro or something. It just had a totally different look from the 90s art at the time, so it had a certain appeal to it, and you're like, wow, it looks pretty neat. And you're like, look at the Beast, and you're like, look at the Angel, he has some weird... He's holding some weird bar on the cover.
So Stan and Jack are sitting around, right? Well, this is Marvel. Let's Marvelize it. Jack's sitting there smoking a cigar with a sketch pad in his hand, and Stan's standing on his desk, like, pantomiming out his plot, okay?
I imagine Stan saying something like, Jack, I'm going to do a story called The X-Men.
Well, they've used radiation as their trope of giving people their powers. They've done it a number of different ways, right? And they need a new hero. Actually, a group of heroes. And a bunch of new villains for them to fight. They've done the literal pull Excalibur, you know, from the stone bit with Thor. They've done radiation from space, from a bomb, bit from an infected radiational, you know, source, having radiation splashed in your face, you know? They did it every kind of a way, but they came up with a great way that would give them an unlimited population of new heroes and villains and superpowered characters. Make them mutants. Genetic
Lazy.
Mutants.
Lazy.
And that's what we'll call the book, too, right? The Mutants. Goodman wasn't having it. Goodman was like, our readers won't know what a mutant is, despite the fact that the book would obviously explain that, but he was interested in selling off the cover. So Goodman nixed that, and they came back with the X-Men title. Goodman said that was cool, and there we go.
And don't they actually call attention to the why it's called the X-Men? Because you always think, well, if he has one woman on the team, why are they calling it the X-Men?
Because the extra power, Kevin.
Yeah, it's extraordinary.
And Professor X.
Exactly.
In the first issue, you basically meet Professor X, and he rounds up the roster of the X-Men and puts them through the paces so we get to see their powers. They all fawn over Jean as she joins the group as Marvel Girl, and he sends them off after Magneto, who gets introduced for the first time, who they chase away from Cape Citadel or something like that.
Yeah, is that supposed to be another place? I'm like, wait a second.
I really like how, you know, right from the get-go, they very cleverly, just as Stan and Jack always did, you know, show how everyone uses their powers and what their powers are. It's funny, the Iceman's, though, it looks like his power is, like, swinging on a stripper pole.
Yeah, that's kind of weird.
Well, he's also, this is his original format when he looked more like a snowman.
Well, you ever notice? Yeah, you ever notice Iceman is sort of like the Thing? He's like constantly evolving. He's never drawn the same way. And it looks like some of the panels look like they're inked differently or like they've been added to or something. You're like, what's up with the Iceman there? Like sometimes he doesn't have eyes or like he's doing weird stuff. Or then he starts making his body colder so that the snow starts or the ice starts crystallizing or doing weird stuff.
Oh, that's in later issues. Right now we've got fresh snowman, and he even makes a joke about looking like a snowman during the training.
There's one spot where he gets his boots on, and then he gets a broom, and corncob pipe and a button nose. And I'm like, what?
And right from the very first pages, we get to see them in the danger room, although it doesn't get labeled that until the next ish.
Is that the danger room, not just some random room?
Well, the next issue, it gets called the danger room. It's obviously their training room here. Cyclops is at a control panel and everything, the classic, early version of the danger room control room. And I recall Stan once saying that was all completely Jack's addition, that they had not talked about doing a danger room, but that became such a big part of the X-Men mythology.
It's cool, but it looks like the stuff is real here. Like, there's flamethrowers, or, like, someone's throwing, like, something at your head, and it's like, oh, good thing I missed that. That would have really knocked me unconscious, and I'm like, wow, you didn't want to mess up in this danger room. That's not virtual.
Yeah, no Shi'ar technology here.
Yeah.
These are definite. And then when they change to meet Jean, that's the part I find interesting, because in the original... Like, Hank has this badass purple jacket.
He sure does.
Pants, and Cyclops is rocking a yellow sweater. But in the recolored, they made it like a blue jacket.
Boo.
And like a green sweater. I'm like, man, they're rocking these crazy looking, like their civilian outfits are even more outlandish than their actual X-Men uniform. Although, I think Jean has the best comment. Her thought bubble. Whoever designed this uniform could have given Christian Dwar a run for his money. And I'm
like
the blue
do you like
and
she's
yellow
coming in from the taxi, and they're all like yelling over the balcony while she's coming in. A redhead, look at that face, and the rest of her. I'm like, what, guys?
Well, Professor X sets them up by saying she's a most attractive young lady.
Exactly. I'm like, if she can't hear you in her mind, she can most definitely hear you another way.
Feel the mind bullets coming from them.
I think the X stands for harassment.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is supposed to be the first time that everyone's meeting Jean Grey, including Professor X, but later it was revealed in the Bizarre Adventures Black and White magazine in that cool Klaus Janson... I think it maybe just inked. It might have been a Buscema Janson, Jean Grey Phoenix story. They revealed that Professor X actually met Jean much earlier in her youth, and her powers were manifesting early, and kind of she was too young to learn what to do with them, and he suppressed them and mind wiped her. So he knows her.
Well, it kind of looks like that they might have met before. They kind of allude to something is going on. So I'm sure that's where they would have got something like that from. But I'm glad she's able to defend herself anyways with her powers against all the boys here.
Yeah, those powers of teleportation. She really needs some schooling. She needs to go to school, obviously, because she keeps calling her powers of telekinesis teleportation.
Well,
twice.
Well, she teleports it from the shelf to right in front of her.
I suppose, but it's not only her powers. It's like Stan Lee has interesting ideas of what some of these powers can do, especially for Magneto. It's like his magnetic waves can do almost anything.
The Miraculous Magneto is introduced, like you say. He calls himself the Miraculous Magneto three times in this issue. He seizes Cape Citadel and proves that, well, magnets are really strong.
I do gotta say that while the X-Men's lackluster outfits, they're fine, they're not anything, I think Magneto's character design is pretty great.
Yeah.
I love the red and purple. The other thing, I love the half cape. Todd McFarlane sort of put an end to that era, I think, of anyone having just a little short. I think there's something about the half cape that is underutilized.
You like the horns on top of the mask too? Classic.
I like them, except sometimes they don't always get drawn in. I guess they were in a hurry to get this one out the door at times. So it's missing from one or two panels. But I do like he's got the horns, he's got the mask, and his face is set back from it, so there's always room for the shadow around his eyes.
So isn't Professor X, totally loaded? One of them's going in a car, another one's going in a plane, and I'm like, jeez.
Yeah, they can charter a boat, they can do all this kinds of stuff. I like when Magneto's making his mark, he, takes over a tank, he takes over a gun, he diverts some missiles that were being tested or something, and then he, with magnetic particles in the air, he writes his, ultimatum in the sky, and then he signs it in cursive, and nice penmanship for magnetic particles in the sky, buddy.
And I don't think all the time you can tell that Angel... that he has his wings strapped down. It's when they mention it, you can see, but otherwise, I'm like, not quite so obvious.
Did you notice, too, on page 15 is that classic, at the bottom is that classic Magneto eyes through the helmet that Lichtenstein manipulated
with
his own ends?
I always like the eyes. And he's just a cool-looking customer. Although, what... I thought was unusual for Marvel, at least the bigger titles. The X-Men fall in the trap of sort of revolving around the same villain a lot in the beginning, which I was like, wow, that's not... One of the things I liked about the other ones is, when you look at Spider-Man, Doc Ock comes back pretty quickly, but they really cycle through a lot of different crazy bad guys.
Now here it's the same bunch over and over again.
So that part I was a little bit... But I gotta say, I would be intrigued if I had... drop my dime and two pennies at the drugstore back in the early 60s. I think I would have been pretty pleased with this initial offer. I also when there's a scene where Magneto he ups his power and it emanates right from his face, like he's giving it a face blast.
To also, when the X-Men show up at Cape Citadel, they're like, excuse us, General, we're college kids.
Yeah.
Perhaps we can help.
Yeah, and he's just like, oh, who cares? They're just going to get themselves killed anyway. Go and do it.
I like, too, Magneto throws at the Angel. He throws, steel, wheels, dumbbells, a barrel, a space capsule, whatever's around. Kirby had a lot of fun drawing, trash.
After they save the day, it's like, mutants are good. Mutants are cool. You saved the world. We like mutants.
And in Magneto's escape, he pushes a rolling cart of flaming rocket fuel at them.
Yeah.
And that general that you mentioned, he calls them uncanny, too, at the end.
Yeah, how about that?
And I think they also quickly do a good job. They establish a relationship, Bobby's the young one. Warren's going to be the smooth guy. Scott's the uptight one. Beast is the smart guy that uses the $6 words. I was impressed how quickly they got that. Although Magneto suffers a little bit of Doctor Doom Submariner-itis a little bit. He's cut from that sort of mold.
Oh, he's just evil through and through, and there's not much depth to him.
Well, also the kind of arrogance that belies the characters are always sort of...
I was actually surprised at how fun this first issue is. I know part of that is because of the time displacement and, the kooky 60s, but... it's pretty fun and exciting.
And the fun keeps on coming. In issue number 2, no one can stop the Vanisher. And this is the first appearance of the Vanisher. And we get the X-Men heeding Professor X's call yet again. And they do some more training in the Danger Room, which gets labeled. And they are called onto the scene because of the Vanisher, who is using his powers also dealing with military targets. And in the end, Professor X uses his powers to defeat him by pretty much mind-wiping him to forget that he even has powers, and it's pretty invasive. But
doesn't it remind you of Reed Richards when he, hypnotized those Skrulls to be cows and all that?
Yes, they're now cows. Don't drink the milk. Don't drink the milk!
Yes, exactly. Moo.
Although
but
I
again,
like...
at the at the beginning of this issue, it seems to be pretty cool that you're a mutant angel. He has freakish wings, and all the girls are going crazy out of him. Hold him! I want his autograph! I want him to kiss me! And I'm like, holy jeez!
Good to be the angel.
On the cover, Professor X's wheelchair has the third wheel in the back. Mm. It was kind of cool. Like, never seen. And there's no handles off the end. It was just like an interesting wheelchair design.
Yeah,
and
I thought the same thing. Having done wheelchair repair and things like that, you know, that's a pretty funny anti-tipper.
Yeah, I wasn't sure how that.
You can still tip to the diagonal, right. So it's like, why not have a tipper on each wheel? But whatever.
Well, I'm also like, how is anyone going to assist him with it? I guess it's the independent person only.
It's like The Simpsons where they found the Edison chair that had the little flap that kept it from tipping over backwards.
I should comment quickly that on the inside of both these are those real He-Man ads for like send off and become a real big muscular dude.
That's what we all want.
I love those ads. But yeah, here we have them blasting in. And again, the villain design, I have no idea what that outfit is made out of, Vanisher. But it's like this cool pink, and he's got almost Dr. Ock style goggles on. And it's, I don't know, like scales. I was thinking more like fluffy, like a quilt type of thing.
Yeah, okay. Not chainmail?
Because it looks softer to me.
Yeah, it does look soft.
And he's also got the half cape again, but this sort of cowl that goes up around and his bald head. Like, he just, there is a guy that doesn't look, that looks pretty different, you know, than any other villain. But I just like, and then the weird, I don't know, snake looking thing on his chest. I don't really know what the Vanisher is up to, but he's bad news, I can tell you. And I like that he has a little, like a gun with his sleeping gas.
You know what's cool? You can hitch a ride in the Mary Moppet Ice Cream Pops truck, too.
Cyclops and Iceman get a ride back home on the in the ice cream truck. Pretty funny. You know, the Vanishers, he's bold. He goes and he'll tell his mark that he's coming after them and still complete the crime. You know, the X-Men confront them and fail epically the first time. I like how there's this like mental contact with the FBI that Professor X has with FBI agent Fred Duncan. It made me think of like Fred Garvin, male, you know. But round two, Dr. X, I mean Professor X, he uses his powers to their fullest ability, and there you go, bang.
Yeah, I'm sensing a pattern here. For
yeah, they go out of their way a couple of times to say how he'll never harm a human being. And then I'm like, but what about he did this and he did that? And then I'm thinking, oh yeah, those were all to other mutants. Like, he so far hasn't actually harmed any human beings. Just mutants.
But there's the Vanisher teamed up with a bunch of old-timey mobsters.
Yeah.
Like Jack Kirby used to love to draw with their Tommy guns. So even though he takes out the Vanisher, we still get a couple pages of the X-Men sticking it to these bad guys wearing their purple suits and plaid orange suits and all kinds of other great outfits.
Everyone's got a hat.
Yeah, it's a serious threat. Like, I never thought much of the Vanisher, but here he's up. He's seriously up to no good.
Yeah, he's a bad dude.
And then he also is aware that he is a mutant. He knows himself as Homo Superior. So I think it's kind of interesting how the concept quickly, like, propagated throughout the universe. And the Danger Room training is pretty cool because there's a scene where these two mechanical fists, like, pop up and the Beast dodges around it. Yeah, I like this. I think it moves very quickly. Like, they don't linger on anything.
And sometimes they have some weird comments about humanity. And, like, the X-Men, I don't know. Like, the next issue when they're trying to get the Blob to join them, I'm like, geez, maybe if you weren't so, not like being a jerk or something, but something about they're like, oh, since we're Homo Superior, we're better than everyone. I'm like, you might want to tone that down a little bit. People might learn to hate you later on.
Well, we're also still in the era of, except for the opening splash page, like they're all 5 to 6 panel, like they don't do many half. They don't do regular splashes or half splashes or anything. So it's kind of a fun storytelling technique. At least I like it.
X-Men number 3 is the earliest original X-Men issue that I have in the bunker.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Got it out of a quarter bin, actually, believe it or not.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, when I was early 80s, maybe 79, 80, something like that.
Wow, that was a deal.
No, it must have been. Yeah. It had to be after the fire, so 81 or 82 it had to be. And X-Men number 3 is the first one that showcased the Angel flying laterally across the cover logo, which I always really thought was cool.
Although the opening splash, they neglect Cyclops' visor, which kind of rankled a little bit. Because normally those were like...
yellow there.
That was normally the nice showcase to it. Because they also made a point that prior to that, he would always have his hands up to adjust it, and he doesn't have his hands in his visor.
Oh, yes!
Well, that becomes a point, because he had his hands trapped behind him, and he couldn't use them. So, in the next issue, I forget who it is, someone's surprised that they've got him by his back, and he can still fire the visor. So that was a fixed vulnerability, I should say. But here we've got Professor X. Again, we get to see the gang training and stuff, and we learn about the Blob, another mutant. That's the mission of the X-Men, to find mutants before the evil mutants find them. And to turn them to their side. So they find the Blob, and they try to recruit him and bring him back to their headquarters. And he says, nah, no thanks. And then they're like, well, you're not leaving here alive. And so all of the animosity over all of the decades between the Blob and the X-Men, it's pretty much the X-Men's fault.
Yeah.
They brought him there, and then they wouldn't leave without, and declared that they were going to mind wipe him. And he's like, I'm not having that. And so he escapes, defeats the X-Men. He's on the side of good here. And then he takes charge of his circus, now that he knows that he's homo superior, and brings all the carnies down and rains them like carny hell down on the X-Men mansion and school. And then we have to do another mass erasure of memories by Professor X when he amplifies his powers by mechanical means.
And I really like the animals, the way they drew them.
I don't know if they're accurate,
but I like the elephant a lot that they have.
Yeah.
But they have them kind
you
of
know
late.
What I really like?
The giraffe.
The panel of the giraffe all of a sudden comes in. It's like out of the blue he starts eating the Iceman's ice cream soda or whatever.
Yep. That's an interesting first strike. But they're totally pining over Jean, right? I mean, here is Professor X admitting his love for Jean.
Oh.
As he fires up a bowl, too.
Oh.
Pretty weird.
Everybody's pipe smoking. So does the Blob smokes a pipe, too. So
Jean finally learns it's telekinesis, so that's memorable.
The professor says, it's telekinesis, Jean, or I'm going to mind wipe you.
The Angel talks about his frozen JD. I'm thinking Jack Daniels, maybe?
Yeah, I didn't get that reference. I don't know what.
And they show the bickering is the norm between them as characters, which works, you know, for the Fantastic Four and that kind of bit. They're a family. This isn't the Avengers here, who are constantly taking, you know, votes on doing things and working with each other like professionals. These guys are at each other. They're kids still.
Yeah, and they were pulling pranks in the first issue, too. Particularly Bobby always likes that.
And the Blob, isn't he so prestigious when he first appears in his cape and he's like on top of the world, you know?
Yeah, he really had the circus life down. He was doing it all, and they don't like... Yeah, they feel an unnecessary need to try and rescue Jean all the time. I like that she sticks up for herself, you know? I know Marvel gets a lot of grief for their treatment of the ladies back in the day, but she's at least trying to stick up for herself.
And with those powers... She can certainly push you away or put you in your place.
Well, yeah, there was a certain circus of crime kind of feel.
Yeah.
To these.
Doesn't one of them show up in like one of these issues? Not this one, maybe the next one or somewhere? Like one of those like the guy that gets shot out of a cannon?
No, it's a similar similar, but it's a different
it's his cousin.
Yeah.
Maybe.
A lot of people getting fired out of cannons.
I liked when the Blob was escaping the X-Men. He, dodges their trail, shakes their trail by escaping down a manhole. And I'm thinking,
oh, yeah, that was weird.
Wow.
Hey, did you know?
I'm thinking
did you
it's
notice
like poo
on,
stuck in rabbit's hole, you know?
Did you see on page 15 the Blob's missing his hair?
Yeah. Interesting. Funny. And also in this issue, we get to see the Angel doing his sharper than 90 degree turn, like vertically, which ends up being a classic. He does it to avoid a lassoing here, but it's a classic maneuver that they'll show him doing again and again.
Well, he also does the double fist upshot that I love so much against the Blob.
I call that the Andrew.
But yeah, it's the they always got to have the strong men and the acrobat guys and then the different animals and the lasso guy. Yeah, it's all fun. I like the circus of crime atmosphere.
When you're part of the circus and you're taking it on Iceman, remember to put on your woolly coats because you'll be able to incapacitate Iceman that way. He won't be able to do anything.
Truth. All right. X-Men issue number 4 was entitled The Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, even though they don't call themselves that at all in the issue.
Well, it's probably not a good idea to call yourself evil.
You gotta represent. The coloring on this cover is one of the classic miscolorings, and interesting that it was fixed for Andrew's masterworks and then reverted back to the original coloring for subsequent reprints. On this cover, the Scarlet Witch is originally colored green, and Quicksilver is colored blue, which is funny because several years later in the Avengers, he would eventually wear light blue.
This was a prescient turn, apparently, for them, but here, in the 87 version, they fix it for some strange reason, along with changing the outfits at different points.
So I have a question about the Iceman this early on. He says his icy protective coating is melting away. I thought his whole body like turned ice, like all the way through. But it's like here it's represented like a weird coating.
I've always thought of it as a coating as well.
Huh. Maybe because I guess in the 90s it's like Onslaught or someone like runs them all the way through and it's like ice. So I'm wondering at what point
he's like ice. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I always thought that he couldn't, like, lose a limb and grow it back. Made of ice, you know?
Really? No, I just thought it was
a circuitry under there somewhere.
But what I do like, the opening splash has the most extreme perspective. The Beast is staring, and it's just a head, feet, and hands, kind of like. Like, it's a crazy visual image.
Yeah, I mean, these opening splashes, we've had 4 issues, and when the X-Men aren't running to heed the professor's call, they're in the danger room training. It's one or the other.
But it's always something neat. It's like, oh, we're going to put a giant frying pan there, or like a pool, or something that's going to clobber you in the head.
Yeah, this one, Beast was competing for Wipeout, I thought.
But Iceman looks weird in the second page, like the 5th panel. I'm like, what is up with that?
Although, I think this is the first time we see him making those ice slides that everyone probably remembers from Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. Which I just thought was such a clever way to get around.
Yeah. He also makes another pole here. He likes his poles.
And all of Jean's stuff is almost always precision work, you notice? Like, they don't put her in the kind of danger. Hers is like stitching the pattern through the card and everything.
And cutting a cake. Should you be cutting a cake if you're a Cyclops? Like, what about, is it going to go through the table?
Well, he's so good, he can modulate is the one. The other thing they do in this one a lot is they like to cut between. So we go from the X-Men having cake, and the next we smash cut to the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants sitting down to eat their dinner. And they do that a couple times.
Yeah.
And of course, they also like to bicker and fight with each other.
Well, yeah, they established the whole thing about Quicksilver sticking up for Wanda and that whole deal.
Definitely. And that's the whole point of this issue, I think, is to really, showcase that cast of the Toad and Mastermind and the Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch and have them interact with each other and their leader, Magneto, who here he conquers a tiny republic of Santo Marco.
Yeah, what is it? Always in the 60s, like some supervillains conquering some South American country or something, and then it's like, oh, we got to fly there and beat them up now.
And well, once again, they're outmatched until Professor X enters the fray.
Of course.
They wanted to mimic the whole Cuban thing. But the other incident that's interesting is we find out, we're reminded that Magneto actually has a lot of mental powers.
Yeah.
And so they have a little communication on the astral plane right out of Doctor Strange a little bit.
Definitely.
Do you like how he has everyone put M's on their shoulders and like he has even flags with M's on them? And they even show someone drawing and they're like, this castle must have a giant M on it. And I'm just like,
really Gestapo-like.
Yeah. And then, of course, there has to be castles. And I'm like, yes, castles.
Well, they kind of look like they're almost goose-stepping, and the helmets definitely are evocative of... But then again, you know, Kirby would have had plenty of time drawing that those sort of from all the war comics and everything, so he's probably just stealing that design.
Yeah, but I don't mind when castles show up in comics. Always good.
And the Toad call Magneto Magneto here, or the Angel does.
Oh.
Helps you with the pronunciation in case you get it wrong.
Yeah, but he's not Neato. He's like a magnet. He's like magnetism and all that stuff.
I also like at the end when they escape, they have a big escape slide. Whee! And Professor X is caught in a booby-trapped door blast, and it appears that he has lost his mental powers, and he's just like, I'm useless, I'm nothing without my extra power, and he's all martyr-like. He's like, go on without me, I'll be alright, don't worry about me.
Yeah, I'm one of those foolish, stupid humans now.
Yeah, I know, it's pretty pathetic.
Although it is important to know that Quicksilver does come back and save them from Magneto's booby trap.
Yeah.
Which shows that, you know, he and Scarlet Witch are going to be clearly the decent people on that team who are linked to Magneto for an unfortunate way. And I also love the scene where Cyclops uses his I-beam like a battering ram. And so the guys are doing these somersaults that he's pushing them forward in an easy way.
Do you like how he uses his how he uses it right through the keyhole in the next issue to unlock the door?
Yeah, because it was too much trouble to fish for his keys.
Yeah, I'm like lazy.
Why not just blow a hole through the wall?
I know you might as well. That's like Colossus. Door smash.
So the next issue is issue number 5, Trapped One X-Man. Featuring the return of the evil mutants, who you haven't seen since last month. And they're still miscolored on the cover.
But now, you know, Professor X is not no longer almost superior, so they're really treating him gently. And they telekinetically lift him up and put him into bed.
Again, everyone's showing their powers. You know, the Beast is hanging from the chandelier to get his little blankie. You know, it was a clever way. And then the Iceman with his, again, sort of arrogant elitist comment. It sure seems strange to see him sleeping that way. Just like any normal Homo sapiens. It makes me feel so alone.
I know, I'm like, oh, like, no wonder the humans hate you.
Now he's one of them, you know? Pathetic. Like, how's he supposed to sleep with a... you know, metallic crown on hanging from his ceiling or something? Like, what? I don't know. Crazy.
But Jean's parents are visiting, so everyone's got to quickly change back.
Every time I see them, I just think of how the Shi'ar wipe them out eventually. But what's with Jean's mom's hair? It goes from gray to then in the digital version, they have it all red, and it's crazy.
Oh, in this one, it's just the gray. I kind of like that she looks sort of... her parents look appropriately aged. Sometimes when they do older people in comics, you're like, they don't look old. Like, her parents look old.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Cyclops accidentally gets locked in the danger room, and it triggers the Beast training program, so he's got to just blast everything instead of trying to dodge everything.
And Magneto, interestingly enough, we get to see Asteroid M for the first time, his orbiting space station. And what's neat is the architecture on it mimics the remote island that he was using as a base in the previous issue before going to take over Santo Marco there or whatever. So I'm assuming he just lifted that island up into the sky, because in a subsequent issue, he's got another island base and the architecture is all different on it. So I think that's a different base.
And yeah, then later I was really surprised to see Asteroid M so early. I was, I wasn't aware of the in-depth history.
Right. Yeah, this is the first issue I remember reading when I was in Ireland, because there's a bit where the Toad pretends he's an Olympic athlete, and he's with a mask on, and he's destroying all the records, and that freaks everyone out, because they're like, oh my God, he's asked to be a mutant, he's breaking all the records. So the X-Men go to save him, and they pick him up in this dope-looking Cadillac convertible.
Look out, it's that brainless Toad.
And this was all Magneto's plan. And in the beginning, the Toad and the other guys in the Brotherhood are asking for Magneto's plan. And he's like, I'll tell you in my own good time. Nobody tells me. And then like three panels later, he's like, okay, so here's my plan.
He wants to show them who's boss.
And then the Beast susses out that it's Toad in a mask. And that leads to the confrontation. I thought Mastermind, he uses, I like it when he uses the fog illusion, because even if you know it's illusion, it still is effective.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, the thing is they're going to get the Toad, they're accidentally going to try to bring this athlete back in to, because it went so well with the Blob when they brought him in and tried to convince him to join. So, you know, the Toad is hoping to identify where the X-Men live, which is a repeating goal here of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, to find the X-Men's headquarters. I love the panel also with the Brotherhood who kind of lose the Toad in the scuffle, and this is where Quicksilver is holding Cyclops' arms behind his back, and Cyclops is still able to shoot the beam, and Quicksilver even thinks, blast, I didn't even, you know, I didn't realize he could use his power now when he, you know, even without his hands. And then Magneto grabs the Angel and they're running, and it's like, cue the Benny Hill music, man. They're like, they're running on the Toad, leaving him there.
Forget the Toad run. We have the Angel. I'll swap him for that high jumping fool any day.
And I haven't seen a wider stride than Magneto has since Bo Jackson got injured in the late 80s.
Yeah, he is out of there, but he's going to takes the Angel up to try and break him by via different torture. And what manner of man is this Angel? What is the secret of Professor X's training? Why can't I break his will? Why does he resist me? But the Toad is under this weird post-hypnotic suggestion where suddenly he acts all strange and he summons the special magnetically powered spaceship.
Oh, I love the design of that spaceship, and when they're going up to the asteroid.
Yeah, it's got a giant magnet, traditional-looking magnet on the top to like help board it. Yep. And so they end up following the Toad in the spaceship, and that's how they get to Asteroid M.
Yeah, it reminds me of something out of Mega Man or something.
But I think Mastermind really blows his chance because he's throwing some illusions. But then he goes, you'll find out this is no illusion, and pulls a gun. He shouldn't have told him it wasn't an illusion. Just ignored it.
And right.
Then he would have shot them down.
Speaking of being shot down, Asteroid M, I'm afraid it seems to be destroyed.
Oh.
Don't bet your asteroid, kids. And they return home at the end, earthbound, to a smiling, pipe-smoking Professor X.
That's because he's not a horrible regular human anymore.
He was lying the whole time?
And not just that, but he was also mentally spying on them. That's how he reveals it.
Like, I hope Scott's this isn't going to be a character trait that we see again and again over the decades in this Professor.
I'll give the Professor our report. No need to, Scott. I was with you the whole time listening to your thoughts. And I'm like, well, that's a little creepy. you know, Professor, I hope you weren't in my off time when I, you know, was spending some time by myself. But
I was imagining Gene while I was in privately in my room. Hmm.
But the training period is over. They're no longer probationary X-Men.
Yeah, Gene got the advanced course to catch up to the other guys because they've been in school a year, but she hasn't yet.
Yeah, what's up with that? I'm like, already a year has gone by? Well, I guess in publishing time because they weren't monthly.
Well, the first issue you get to see is only when Gene joins the class. They've already been students for a while. That's the year thing. That's what I mean by she was on an accelerated program to be graduating with them. But this isn't their actual graduation. They're just finished with their training period.
Yes.
But they got to do extra studies after that.
Issue 6, we switch up and we get inking by Chick Stone before we'd had Paul Reinman. And I think I like the Chick Stone stuff better, I think. I don't know if you boys had an opinion.
Yep.
But we have a pretty sweet little opening panel where they're all at the breakfast table griping and Bobby's putting some unsweetened ice cream, apparently, that he's making up, unless he can generate sugar as well.
He always does that. That's like his thing.
Even though Sam Rosen was the letterer, do you see who wrote the Beast's advanced math book? It's Artie Simek, another Marvel bullpen letterer.
Although, in a few issues before, he was reading advanced calculus, so now he's just gone back to advanced math. And with this issue, you can earn big money learning electrical appliance repairing at home in your spare time.
Oh.
You can make up to $5 to $6 per hour.
If I only had spare time. The thrust of this issue is a race. Meaning Professor X and Magneto, who is identified as the second most powerful mind behind Professor X in the world. They have determined that the Submariner is a mutant. So let's go find him. So they do their astral form things, and they're looking all around underneath, you know, sea urchins and things, and in between, you know, sea anemones, and looking everywhere to try to find him. Magneto finds him first and recruits him, but he ends up not liking how Magneto treats Wanda. And in the end, ends up just splitting, basically, after he makes sure that Wanda is safe.
Although, I thought it was pretty interesting that Professor X runs away when he senses Magneto. He's kind of, you'd think on the mental plane he would have the advantage.
And they have that sweet magnet machinery here.
He's all about the magnet machinery, and the horns on his helmet have now become the little talisman kind of emblem that would be the more modern version, rather than being two, you know, separate horns in the classic devil positions.
And I don't know if I'd follow Xavier's directions to the letter in some of these things. It says, it will take less time than you suspect. Without stopping, walk straight into the spine roots. You first, Cyclops!
Just go ahead.
Yes, sir. If you say so. Ow!
And this is Marvel, so Aquaman wasn't available to go first, so
yes. I had to...
Cyclops, you go first. I like Magneto's weapons cachet as he's considering what giant gun to use to go after Namor with. And this is to convince him to join. It's like Rob Liefeld gone wild.
But they were never going to... I mean, there was no way that Namor and Mags could ever get together. They were just, and the Submariner's particularly in an unhappy mood.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks to Editor Note, Fantastic Four, number 27.
Mm.
So I like that, you know, we're keeping in the whole universe. And as usual, Scarlet Witch also has no control over her powers. Every one of these, she's always accidentally hexing people.
Accidentally pointing in someone's direction, right?
Yeah. That you'd think she'd wear mittens or something to prevent that.
How about Submariner's tricked out vehicle with the big S on the front of it, rather for Submariner rather than an A for Atlantis?
or N for Namor or any other one. But and we also get a reference to when he teamed up with the Hulk. So this is kind of, he's tried this before and it never seems to work out. Yeah. Now, what's in the original issue, and you boys have, but my hardcover is missing, is the special pinup page with Cyclops.
Oh yeah.
Signed really... by Cyclops himself in cursive.
Yeah. Sincerely yours, Scott Summers.
It's pretty cool.
You know what's also pretty awesome? On the letters page that says, that's titled, Let's Visit the X-Men. Well, that's not that catchy. It says there's a special announcement section. And it says a lot of people, zillions, wanted the X-Men to go from bi-monthly to monthly. But they have to figure out a way to produce more than 6 issues a year. And then it goes into the whole debate about whether the Submariner is a mutant or not. Send your letters in, and we'll print them, and you can all go crazy whether this is the case.
Cool. They'd be mining that for decades.
Yes, they would.
I believe he's Marvel's first mutant, according to his most recent series.
Right.
But I like it ends with the classic Marvel where he's just walking away off. I mean, how many books have they got with the guy just walking off?
There were a couple of sequences that caught my eye, too. One is they, you know, are able to charter a big ship, you know, a big double-sailed ship, and it gets blown to smithereens, so I bet they're not getting their deposit back. The panel where they get blown to smithereens, you can see all of them, you know, being blown off the ship into the water, including Professor X, who's, like, going headfirst in his wheelchair, right? Professor Overboard, man.
I know it doesn't look good, but it almost looks like he could have put something on the bottom of his wheelchair.
Well, that's kind of the cool move that the Beast does. He kind of gets this little crate box kind of thing and like scoops up the professor with it and holds him up in his wheelchair. But then when the Iceman makes like an ice bridge and they put the professor on it and they're all cruising, they leave the professor in the little box.
I'm like, what?
So it's like no matter how hard he wheels, he's not going anywhere.
Maybe he's still sliding because it's icy.
A little help here, guys? Come on. No wonder he's telling Cyclops to walk into the spines 2 panels later.
I thought that was to get him back for, you know, secretly spying on them last issue.
And this is where the Beast's lingo really gets, I think, amplified to what we would be more used to. He starts really using a lot of vocabulary, including the calling Namor a piscatorial pirate. And piscatorial, I even had to look.
That have to do with fish.
Refers to being a fisherman, related to a fisherman. Yeah. And the Magno ship is named.
I got a feeling
Magneto's Magno ship.
Professor X might not have earned all that money that he came to. If you want my honest opinion, the other thing that's weird is it looks like they gave at times. They wanted to make Magneto's hands into gloves, and other times it's just wristlets. So I think there was some confusion among the coloring art team among that. But yeah, I like Quicksilver's weird little tufts of hair that stick up that sort of mimic Wanda's face mask. And this sort of formal, like almost like a jacket, almost like a Nehru jacket type outfit.
Yeah, I guess she found it too awkward under the chin, so she took that out later.
And you can't say it's a mischaracterization of Namor because it's Jack and Stan, right? And they did the FF book too. But we can pretty much, it's pretty clear here that Namor is pretty much in it for himself and any hot chick that might be around.
Of course.
Yeah. Although he's pretty suspicious of he doesn't want to fall in love again, you know, with all the problems he's had.
Well, that's because he's thinking with his mind there. He's thinking a little clearer as he approaches the water. X-Men 7 is the return of the Blob and the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants.
Also co-featuring the evil who you know who's.
Aha, that's them.
Yes, apparently.
I'm betting anything. The X-Men graduate here. We said they finished their training, right? So here's their graduation
already?
Day.
That's like Peter Parker graduating high school.
No, it's Professor X pulling stuff again, because he wants to go chase down this guy Lucifer, who he claims took out his legs. He doesn't say so here. He's all about the, you guys are all ready, and I'm going to pass the torch, and I'm going to name Scott the leader, and I'm, you know, you guys, you're ready. And meanwhile, he's just off, you know, on a self-serving mission.
And in the first one, he mentioned he lost the use in a childhood accident, too. So I'm starting to think I can't always trust what Professor X tells me.
Really? Hmm.
And the diplomas are blank, too. Gee, as Iceman points out.
You get nothing with your college education.
But
it's filled with
nothing. I like how Mastermind is still trying to put the smoothies on Wanda, but he hasn't figured out now to put the illusions over his own ugly mug. which he would figure out later on.
The basic angle on this, other than their graduation and all of the character moments within, is the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants trying to recruit the Blob. And he thinks about it, but it didn't go so good for the X-Men, so he ends up not really wanting to join Magneto either, and gets blasted and accidentally protects the X-Men from Magneto's blast. It's funny, Magneto's happy to sacrifice the Blob. He's about to fire the blast, and everyone's standing around him going, but the Blob's over there! And he's like, ah, that's his own problem. And then he gets in the way and blocks the blast, and then he's all pissed that he's in the way.
But they jump in the Magna car and take... And the Magna car is crazy looking. Like, it's kind of got a bit of the bathtub design, but it's covered, and it's got, like, different sets of wheels on the bottom. Like, the vehicles that in the X-Men book are the best.
But you know what else makes a first appearance in here that's pretty pretty important to the X-Men?
It's that weird thing that he's kept in that dark and locked section of the school.
Yeah, that he's been working on for some time.
Cerebro? Or is it Cyberno?
Either or.
You know, it's funny, they fixed it in the digital Unlimited, Marvel Unlimited version. They accidentally call Cerebro, after identifying it as Cerebro, they call it Cyberno a couple of times. And what's funny here is that Roy Thomas, years later, I think it's in the backup of X-Men issue number 40, with him being such a continuity protector and creator, they explain that Cyberno was a prototype of Cerebro to try to make up for the mistake. So no prize for you, true believer.
Although they don't really need to, because, like, the Professor X is telling him this, right, at a pretty big moment. It's not like Scott's paying attention. Because right after, he's like, oh, guess what, Scott? You're going to be the leader, and I'm going to go take off on a cruise of Europe. See you later. So it could be pretty stressful. Like, I could see Scott mishearing the name or not, like, oh, he calls it Cyberno because he just found out about it, and it's not like he's like,
but you don't see that much in comics. You don't something. See characters going like, what was your name again?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we all make mistakes, and I think that it's perfectly reasonable that in light of all this crazy business, like, he ended up getting the name wrong. And also, they're still doing the romance angle, because even Angel sees that, like, Scott and Jean have a spark, but neither one of them can act on it, because now Scott's the leader of the X-Men and he's all stressed out about that, and that puts him in a different situation. But here we have
only Scott.
Yeah.
We have, like, a great clown, though. I really like the clown face, like the creepy looking clown when Magneto's walking through the circus. And it's the old Hey Rube, where we get the crazy, crazy circus folk attacking people.
Carnies! Who doesn't love carnies in comics? Come on.
So
how long do you think Scott stays at this desk until that thing goes off? It seems like he can't leave the room. He can't go to bed. It's like, I gotta stay at this device that's beeping away until it checks off one of the names that's listed as known hostile mutants.
Yep, he's on guard. The other thing that's funny is they introduce some supporting side characters in out at the little nightclub place where they're at, hanging out, and one of them is Zelda, the waitress that Bobby talks to, and she becomes a recurring person, actually, and she ends up getting the name, but not until, like, in the 2000s or, like, in the late 90s in a version of an Ohotmu, a official handbook of the Marvel Universe. She was given the last name Kurtzberg after Jack Kirby's original surname. So she's Zelda Kurtzberg.
And then I also like how they go through yet another vehicle, and this time it's a helicopter. Old Professor X's bank account's flying.
Well, he's not here. We can spend his money freely.
It ends with a joke of them like, oh, wait, we don't have any cab fare, you know, because how are they going to get home?
I like that Magneto's hiding out in now a ramshackle mansion high on a windy hill. He went from an island to a satellite to an island again to a mansion on a windy hill.
Are these all abandoned places, or is he buying all this stuff, too? Maybe he has some of that sweet, sweet cash from World War II or something.
He's a crazy man who loves to clench his fists, which I love in the old-timey comics. Nothing like a few panels with his fists clenched. And again, we have the Blob walking away, much like Namor did.
Yes.
Ridiculous as it may seem, I almost find myself pitying that tragic human behemoth.
And he vows that he's never going to get involved with any of this crazy mutant stuff again.
Makes sense. Good to make a promise you'll be able to keep following on. Good to set a limit you're ready to enforce. X-Men number 8 in kind of the fall of 1964 was associated the uncanny adjective again with this title, but this time it's the uncanny threat of Eunice the Untouchable. So they could get the three U's in there. Uncanny, Eunice, and Untouchable.
Eunice is the best, man. This guy.
I like Eunice a lot. But it wasn't until that Marvel fanfare with him and the Blob, the buddy story, where the Blob is like the only one who can get through Eunice's out of control power feed him the food, and like the spoon's like bending as he's getting it to his mouth, but he's like, that's what a buddy will do for a buddy kind of thing. That was I think it was a Hulk story, but that was a good one.
They do seem well matched in that reign. And again, we start out with them doing their training in the danger room, but here we have the first appearance of Iceman not being Snowman anymore.
Yes.
He's crystalline now.
He also has a pole again.
Somebody talk to him about that pole.
Yeah, I know. And it looks like Beast is like, whoa, Jean's threading those laces through those holes.
Well,
yeah, again, Jean gets the arts and crafts portion of the danger room.
I know. It's always like, oh, you got to do this precisely. You're going to need to know this one day.
Yep. That'll happen.
I know.
Well, Eunice's deal is he's got the force field around him, so he's a cheating wrestler. You can't knock him down, right? And even the Beast, who flirts with leaving the X-Men, tries to use his powers to cheat, and the both of the cheaters, Eunice still comes out on top as the better cheater, his power. So no one can touch this Eunice unless there's something coming through his force field that isn't intended to cause him any harm. So we got the issue here that Professor X is gone. So you can't do the old Professor X comes in and mind wipes everybody deal.
But we do get a shot of him with his motorized wheelchair.
Yeah. He's like descending into this hellish pit, and then he claims he's looking for Lucifer. I'm like, what?
And he has those weird tractor treads on his wheelchair and everything. And of course, Scott, the panel before, is like freaking out over, I'm the most terrible leader ever.
Yeah, well, he's potentially lost Hank. And then he fears that he's going to go join Magneto or something like that. Well, that's not going to happen. But there
only
is
Colossus
that...
would do that.
Yeah, right. There is that, test of conscience, basically, where they have to sort of trust Hank. They've got no Professor X to mind wipe Eunice the Untouchable here, so how do you defeat him? Well, Hank's pretty smart. He comes up with a device, and they're like, cool, he's coming up with a device that's going to neutralize his power. And Hank's like, nah, I'm coming up with a device that's going to amplify his power. And they're all like, no, no, no. And they're chasing after him. And they're like, don't do it. I can't believe he would turn like this. And, oh, Hank, how could you have sunk so low? But amplify Eunice's power, he does.
You ever think about what if Peter Parker would have went to a wrestling thing when Eunice was there? Or, like, the Hulk was in the same circus as those other guys from the earlier issues? Like, there's weird almost crossover things.
And then, but as a result, he can't pick up his smokes, he can't eat any food, he's driven crazy by the fact that he can't get anything near him. And that was the point. And so Hank goes and readjusts his power level, but he's like, look, Eunice, you ever mess with me or know anybody again, we're going to hit you and we'll throw the antidote away. Basically, it's a death sentence.
In the meantime, though, let him eat cake.
and then he'll walk slowly away at the end of the story again.
Yeah, he's going back to wrestling where he belongs, even though he can't apparently wrestle at all. He's never at least shown any ability. He cheats at wrestling, so if that's where he belongs, that's pretty lame.
Well, he can just do that acting portion and, you know, fake the wrestle.
Then the pinup is, appropriately for this issue, the Beast, after such a Beast-oriented issue. And he's balancing on one finger on a little string, and he's like, that's a pretty tight juggling arc he's got going with one hand.
Yeah.
A bunch of things.
What is he juggling?
Just the things like, that would like be around the house.
Like the ones, he also signs his pinup as well.
Yeah. He's probably signed it with his foot.
But I hate to break it to you, Steve. I think most of the wrestling is fixed. I'm not an expert, but I don't think it really matters that Eunice cheats. I think they're all in the fix. Like,
yeah.
So
don't tell me it's entertainment instead of actual wrestling.
I mean, you know, they're certainly athletes, and it's a skill, and it's definitely dangerous. But I'm not going to pretend that. You know, that's the part I found surprising, was I wondered if back then they seemed to buy into this narrative that, like, wrestling is, you know, a contest between these two individuals.
Well, these were more like the classic comic book trope of, like, kind of just a betting ring somewhere, right? Like,
yeah.
This could just be, like, on the side of the boardwalk at Coney Island, you know, some guy getting a bunch of people together and taking bets. You know, it didn't seem like it was a, you know, a night at the WWE or whatever.
You know what issue 9 looks like? X-Men versus Avengers.
AVX, baby.
You know it.
And we also get Professor X on the trail of Lucifer, facing trap after trap. This Lucifer guy, though, he's a lot like the Master of the World from John Byrne's Alpha Flight. He's got the same helmet, although it's purple. He's even an alien in origin. And they color Lucifer, like, with the same color scheme as Magneto. Like, what's up with that?
Although I like so, Professor X packing heat.
Yeah.
Like, you gotta have a gun. I mean, you know, that's Professor X. And, like, people, like they do now, you gotta have crossovers, man. Who are you gonna cross over? You gotta have Avengers and X-Men. I mean, that seems like a natural.
I did like the contrast of the two teams that, like, you know, the one, again, like I was jokingly alluding to before, they're, like, you know, taking group votes and stuff and making motions even in the field, and our guys are all over the place.
You see the Professor's sweet wheelchair. Like, look at all these things that just come out of it. They can put you down in, like, a mine shaft and, like, anything.
Oh, holy cow, check this out. I was looking at the Marvel Unlimited digital version where they do the same color scheme as Magneto. The original color scheme is the green and purple. So I go I subscribe to that. On the Marvel digital, they have his tunic and pants red and his cape and helmet and gloves and boots purple.
Oh, interesting.
It's very Magneto-y. I will post a picture on the forum and tweet it and all that sort of stuff.
That's interesting. I wonder where they pull their source material from. Because some of it seems to match, but some of it doesn't.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, they might have had shortages of one color or another or something like that. I don't know that they were holding it too. But you're right, Professor X has upgraded from the wooden wheelchair to the fancy mechanical all devices, but we find out that
all terrain.
Yeah, it reminds me of, like, a chariot or something with, like, spikes coming out of the sides and, like anything you would need.
It's like Thanos' chair.
Or it's even like his hover chair, except this one. It's like, oh, I'll just press all these buttons and, like, anything you need. It's like a utility belt.
And he could take that into the field.
Yeah.
But it turns out that Lucifer is not a very nice man, despite his name Lucifer. And he has a thermal bomb large enough to blow up a continent, and he's rigged it to his heartbeat.
Ugh. The heartbeat trick.
Oh.
So that way they can't stop him, and Thor, is tracking evil through his hammer.
Do that?
And so he wants to take on Lucifer, but the X-Men receive the mental command that they can't let the Avengers attack Lucifer right now because it would destroy this bomb. And in traditional Marvel fashion, they can't explain that. They have to just start fighting.
Yep. But then they take a vote.
You might as well. And
they also establish that, like, Thor would eventually have mopped the floor with all of them. And they feel kind of lucky to get by. So he's still his place as the top dog, I think, is well established here. And, of course, obviously Marvel Girl and the Wasp have to tangle it up. They got to keep, you know, we can't have
a hair-pulling scene, of course, between the two girls. The Wasp pulls Jean's hair and occludes her vision with it. How catty.
And then Professor X, of course, reasons with Lucifer. Doesn't use his mental powers this time.
He doesn't use his gun either.
Until he shuts down his brain and leaves him so only his heart is beating to keep the thing going. He's laying there with his arms outstretched. There might as well be a chalk outline around him laying on the floor there. And Cyclops and Professor X get to the top. Angel helps Professor X, for those of you who are like, what do you mean Professor X gets to the top? They get to the top of the bomb, and here we get Cyclops doing my favorite maneuver here that Jerry McDade and I talked about so many times and have seen a bunch of different times, and it's Cyclops shooting vertically down into a deep, precise point, and in this case, blasting a fuse.
Yeah, thip.
You know, if this bomb would have went off and there would have been a tidal wave in New York, that would have been, what, maybe the third or fourth tidal wave by this point? Oh, poor New York. I assume it's New York.
Yeah, I would guess so.
Yeah, and it's weird. So he lets Lucifer go because Professor X won't harm a human.
Tell that to him 10 minutes ago.
He's ready to shoot the guy.
And then this is where we find out that, in fact, he did cause the loss of his legs. Mm-hmm. Because Professor X is like, hey, you know, I lost my legs. You were lucky.
Yep.
You just lost 10 years of your life building that bomb.
Mm-hmm. And the pinup is Marvel Girl, and she
No wonder
is,
they call her Marvel Girl.
She's teleporting, I mean, levitating a little picture of her paramour there, Professor X. And what is she, growing lily pads in that, in that vase? And I guess they got Mike Zeck to come in and draw her feet.
Well, her right hand is a little kooky as well. So.
Yeah, well, it's almost like she's doing the puppeteer act over the things that she's levitating, right? To like be like dangling them as if they are a mobile.
Yes, yeah, her hands are pretty small compared to the rest of her.
She almost has the hoof feet there too.
Yeah, right. I mean, it looks like Mike Zeck feet from the Secret Wars in the early '80s there, or mid '80s. Pretty cool.
But that was Lucifer. I mean, you know, hard to believe he warranted a complete song by Black Sabbath about him.
Are you sure that's the same Lucifer? That one might be about Mephisto.
I'm pretty sure. I mean, his name is Lucifer. The guy in the song is Lucifer.
It can't be two Lucifers.
No. I mean, it's a pretty unusual name, but I know Steve is excited for issue 10.
Issue 10 is the coming of Kazar in the beginning of
1965. They even tell you how to pronounce it.
Yes, Kazar. Which is funny because Kazar was originally a pulp hero, right? And he was David Rand was his name as a pulp hero. That's right. Kazar wasn't Kevin Plunder. He was David Rand. That's where they got the name for Danny Rand. And Kazar's saber-toothed tiger pet was named Zar. Not Zabu.
But yeah, what episode did you cover that on?
I don't know. Not like within the last year.
But he's the most spectacular new character of the year, Steve.
But they are bringing in Kazar from... He did appear in the pulps, and he did appear in the first run of Marvel Comics. Marvel Mystery Comics. Yeah. Marvel Comics. And that's when he had this different presentation. But this is Avengers number 4 Cap right here. This is Kazar being updated and brought into the modern Marvel universe here in X-Men number 10.
And Zaboo.
Doesn't Jean creep you out on the first page? Or, I guess after the splash, she's like disassembling the rifle and then reassembling it, and I'm like, wow, that's pretty precise.
Well, she asked not to do the stitching today.
Yeah, I guess so. She's like, that's too much like sewing clothing. Jeez, of course you give the woman that. And I also think back to like the whole all-new X-Men now with Bendis, like when she disassembles motorcycles and stuff like that. It's like, yeah, this is definitely a callback to this era.
Well, there's more of the romance stuff, too, where their thought bubbles wonder why Scott and Jean can't get together.
Yeah, they're both like, oh, I can't believe you don't see me that way, and another person's thinking the same thing.
There are news reports about a lioncloth wild man in Antarctica, and a saber-toothed tiger. And that piques the X-Men's curiosity, and they head to Antarctica and manage to find the secret tunnel to the Savage Land.
Did you know Iceman's being a juvenile Jerry Lewis here?
La la la, nice lady.
Hot dog.
They find Kazar and Zaboo. And Kazar and Zaboo, of course, you know, face off against the X-Men until good old Magor shows up, the last of the man-ape tribe. And Kazar swiftly defeats him as he does so many times.
Holy jeez, I think that's a brontosaurus.
You know, and I love the guy's got this concoction that fires like four arrows at once. That's very cool. Yeah. Kirby always was good with the crazy technology like that.
Yeah. And we get the angel flying around with pterodons chasing him and stuff and all the good Savage Landy kinds of things to establish the threat. The tribes there, the Swamp Men, they ride on feral beasts and escape with the girl. So we got to go rescue the girl, and Kazar and Zaboo are all up for that. So let's all team up and go rescue the girl.
And you know what panel I really know in here that I'm sure I've seen somewhere else before? The one where Kazar is, like, his legs are really stretched out, and then Iceman is, like, rolling all the criminals in that giant snowball?
Yeah.
That must be reprinted somewhere else, because I looked at that, I'm like, I've seen this many times before.
I've seen the same figure but in a Captain America suit throwing around Hydra agents, you know? Like a room full of Hydra agents or Nazis or something. But yeah, it's that moving forward, but having the weight behind your head throwing thing that Kirby really liked to do.
Yes, yes. And I like that this one doesn't end with him walking away, but ends with him pounding his chest like Tarzan.
It's so neat how they get into the Savage Land, too. I'm like, I don't know if you usually see that. Like, with all the dead bodies and the skeletons and everything like that?
Yeah, but by the time the 70s and 80s come around, you know, it's been traveled to so many times that that's been cleaned up.
Or there's just a lot of pop cans and debris.
Or like Spider-Man, you always crash land in the Savage Land.
That's right. And then a volcano is about to explode or something.
Nobody ever has a good landing in the Savage Land.
Or Roxxon's there drilling for oil.
And vibranium. They say they're drilling for oil, but it's really vibranium.
Yeah.
All right, gang. That's the first 10 issues of the X-Men, Stan and Jack and company.
Certainly was better than Worthless. Am I right? Am I right?
I like that. I like these old comics. I think they're fun.
Especially reading them with you guys. Kirby would only stick around until issue number 17, and then Werner Roth would take over with Dick Ayers' inks. So there were 7 more issues of Stan and Jack, and then not too long after that, Stan would leave the book and Roy would take over, and the rest is X-Men history.
Oh, we never got to do the Sentinel Master Mold issue. But anyways, maybe another time.
I also think the Juggernaut one. Like, as a kid, I didn't realize that when they copped that on Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, that was right from the comic.
Oh, yeah.
Because I only had this first edition. I only had the first 10. So I didn't have the next series. So it was fun reading those later on, but we'll see. We'll see if this X-Men thing will stick around. Maybe it's just a flash in the pan.
Well, we might get replaced with something else, and then you know, it'll keep on getting reprinted in like filler episodes of Marvel Noise, and then it'll get relaunched later on.
I say we tell Phil it's safe to come back, and we hit up some the next batch of number ones next time around, and then maybe we could hit the next, at least the Kirby issues, do the next seven, and finish off Jack and Stan's X-Men.
Sweet.
Sounds good to me. All killer, no filler.
Keep making mine. Marvel now. Oh, wait.
Later. I can't eat. I can't sleep. Knowing that you're on your midnight creep. I can't jump. I can't jive. Knowing that you want me dead or alive. There's no halfway with you. You see red, white, and blue. What holds your head up? Use another screw. Oh, come on, do your worst, boy. That's the way. That's the way. Hit me where it hurts, boy. That's the way. That's the way. Puff until you bust, boy. That's the way. That's the way. But I'll never give it up. I'll never give it up. I put you. You are, and what you're not. Oh, come on.